All right. Hope you got a handout. Realized as I was handing these out this morning, we had some copier misfires, and some of them didn't get a back page. So if you didn't get a back page, we've got a couple of extras that we can pass around, and we would not want you to be with only part of the story here. We're talking about trying to help someone come to faith in Jesus. And we realize that that is a journey of faith. It's not just something that you just flip on or off like a light switch. It takes time for people to come to faith. It took time for me. I'm sure it took time for you. There are many of us who have struggled in various ways. And a lot of people have tried to chart what progress in faith looks like and how it moves from stage to stage. And probably the most famous chart like that is called the Engel scale. And if you've read anything on church growth, you've come across the Engel scale at some point. This guy named James Engel put it together and published a book in 1975 where he had this Engel scale of how people are moving toward faith in Christ and then what happens to them after they come to some point of obedience. And so others have adapted and adopted that and changed it, and I make really no apology for having done exactly the same thing. And on the back page today, we're going to go through this Engel scale. This is the Stinnett paraphrase of the Engel scale. We're going to move through that. And so that we can have the whole thing preserved intact, I went ahead and put it on the back side. It just wouldn't fit on one side if we had any print as well. What we're trying to do is move a person one step closer to obedience. So what I want you to do now is just flip the thing over to the back side so you can see how this great huge chart works. And what I want you to understand is this isn't nearly as complex as it looks at first. This is plain old common sense, honestly. You stop to think about this and you understand that you have moved through many of these stages, and at different times in your life, you've had to move from one step to another. This is just the way it goes. So let's just start at the bottom. You can kind of think of this as a rocket taking off, or a ladder to climb, or steps to go. It doesn't matter. However, what, or even just moving from one side of the room to the other. And so let's just talk about this. You start at the bottom with people who just have a superficial awareness of God. They really don't think about God at all. He's an occasional profanity over split knuckles or something like that. And, you know, he really doesn't have any impact in their lives at all. And you realize that you see this behavior in them that kind of demonstrates this. They're self-directed. They discuss and decide what is truth and what's not in their lives. They just choose how they're going to live, what they're going to do. They never, ever, ever would appeal to a standard higher than themselves. It's just all about what makes them feel good and what they think they're doing there. They typically will avoid truth. And they kind of disdain faith. Now, for some people who are in this position, they are pretty hostile to faith, and they can be really unkind and rude about it. But quite a few of them are not hostile and rude. They just don't care, and they are just kind of disinterested, and they think that you're a little bit silly. And that, I think, probably described my father-in-law, who I've told you before thought that I was just a complete idiot, as, you know, many of my family think I'm a half-wit, but he didn't even give me that much. He thought I was completely out of it. What these people need to help them move to the next step is they need your presence. They need some kind of an emotional connection and a cultivation of friendship. There's really not much more you can do here with these people except to be there for them, to be a friend, to be a kind of an emotional connection. Now, I want to take you to the book of Acts particularly and take you to several passages that may help you to see an illustration of how this works. And in Acts chapter 17, you know, you have Paul in Athens, and he's talking to the Athenian philosophers, and they're supposed to be the smartest guys in the world. Ask any of them, they'll tell you they are. The smartest guys in the world. And so he's talking to them, and when he gets to the part about the resurrection of the dead, that's what flipped the circuit breaker for them. Because in the ancient world, people didn't know much, but one thing they knew for sure is when you're dead, and that's it. It's all over then, and nobody ever comes back. So in verse 32, in Acts 17, 32, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, well, we want to hear you again on this subject. Some of them sneered. N.T. Wright, I think I talked to you about this book, The Resurrection of the Son of God. Fascinating book. One of the things that he does is demonstrate very impressively in this book, that in the ancient world, nobody, and I mean nobody, thought that people would come back from the dead. There would be no one ever presumed that there would be a bodily resurrection. Jew, Gentile alike, nobody believed that. And so when it happened, when Jesus did that, that was a huge hurdle of faith for some people to come over. Well, you've got this one person who just has this kind of superficial awareness of God and have kind of a disdain for faith. They're not really locked into that very much. A step above that is when you come in contact with someone who does in fact believe there is a God. Now, they don't have a very good definition of God, may not understand anything about Him, but they just kind of believe there is a God. They're still self-directed, though. They're self-directed because in their understanding that there is a God, they would never appeal to Him for anything. They don't have a very clear picture of who God is or what He does or anything about that. So they presume that their truth is the best truth. They live the way they think is best. Now, they kind of know that there's a God out there, but they presume that He's just like us. And so whatever they would do is what He would do, and so on. Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian Herodotus, said that every man thinks his own laws are best. And I think that that's true. People think their own cultural customs are the best ones there are. And this is kind of where this guy lives. He thinks that his truth is the best truth. But he tries to be tolerant of faith. There are people out there who don't see it his way, and that's okay for them because that's their truth, but I got my truth and you got your truth, and we'll all be happy together and everything's fine. Again, what they need, what these people need, is your presence. They just need you to be there. And they need an emotional connection with someone who is known to be a Christian. The reason for that is they don't have a very clear picture of who God is at all. They don't know anything about Him, and they don't know anything about Christians, and what they've heard about Christians is probably not very flattering, because they get it off of television, they get it out of the magazines, movies, and so on. And every time, you know, typically when someone is brought out to be a person of very, very strong faith and conviction on television and in the movies, you know for sure he's the bad guy in the drama, right? Have you noticed that? Anytime somebody has strong faith convictions, he's the bad guy. So you just, there's no mystery after that. You might as well turn it off. It's kind of like watching a New England Patriots football game. There's no mystery to it. You just go on. Okay, in Acts chapter 17 and verse 21, You see some people like this. They kind of believe there's a God. They don't know much about Him. Verse 21, it says, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. They've got some truth. They think theirs is best, and they're just going to hang on to that. They have kind of a superficial awareness of God. They don't know much about Him. So Paul can say, you got these altars everywhere. Wow, you guys... someone said, and I don't know who it was, said there are more gods than men in Athens because every man had multiple gods, so you know, you have more gods than men. This is what will move these people to the next level, and remember that your task in evangelism is to kind of see where they are and try to move them one step closer to the Lord. Okay. The next step up is where people begin to accept responsibility to God. Again, they may not know very much about God. They may not read the Bible. They may not know much of the Scriptures at all. But they do kind of understand that they're responsible to Him in some way and that He does punish wrongdoing. So they kind of believe that there is a hell, they may not think that anyone that they have ever met will go to hell, but they do think that, you know, some of the most heinous characters in history will certainly wind up there. Your Hitlers, your Stalins, your Jeffrey Dahmers, and people like that are going to wind up in hell. Ordinary people probably won't. So what that does with them is it means that they try to do the right thing most of the time. They have fairly high developed morality, and they'll try to do the right thing most of the time. And they kind of respect people of faith. Again, they may not know very much about faith, but they'll try to respect that a little bit. Let's skip over to chapter 18 in Acts 18 and see kind of an illustration of someone like this. We're going to start in verse 12 and read down through verse 16. This is a guy named Gallio. His brother was Seneca, a famous Roman moralist, playwright, tutor of Nero. Seneca was. Seneca said that Gallio was the best man who ever lived. He didn't know Jesus. But apparently Gallio was a very fair-minded individual. In verse 12, we've got Paul in the city of Corinth. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, which is the capital would be Corinth at this point, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him into court. And anybody could bring anybody into court. You just grab them and take them there. This man, they charged, is persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. Now, when they say the law, they mean the Mosaic law. But they want Gallio to think it's contrary to Roman law. So they want him to get all ginned up and excited about it. And verse 14, just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to the Jews, "If you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you. But since it involves questions about words and names and your own law," he didn't fall for this, "and your own law, settle the matter yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things." So he had them ejected from the court. Just kicked them out. Seems to be a very fair-minded sort of guy, tries to do the right thing most of the time. What people like this need is your presence and modeling of Christian behavior. They need to see you at work doing something. And also you can talk about Bible texts to them because they do accept some responsibility to God and they do have some respect for faith and people of faith. So you can kind of talk to them about some of the scriptures and point out some of the better known passages particularly. They're probably already familiar with those and you can kind of launch into a discussion from there. Let me just kind of stop here for a minute and ask if you got any comments or questions about this. Do you see anybody? I mean, when you look at these categories, do you see anybody that you know? I mean, there are a lot of people that fall into these categories, and you see by the way they behave, you can tell what they think or what they believe about these things. I'm not suggesting at all that these are rotten, terrible people. What I'm saying is they are in a particular position in their journey of faith, and here's how you can kind of help them, or maybe help them, move on to the next step in their journey of faith. Well, we're kind of using this scale. Minuses would be below obedience to the gospel. They have not yet come to that point of obedience. And then the pluses would be in their progression after their baptism, after they have committed themselves to Christ, what happens in their lives beyond that. So the pluses are just going to take them on farther above. We're all someplace on this journey of faith, so here's a bit of a challenge. Maybe you can find yourself on the angle scale. Yes, sir? And probably not. Even if they are members of some religious group, they may still be people who are they're not very conversant with Bible texts. They may not know very much of the Bible. They may not have very strongly developed faith in God. And I'm not trying to be ugly or judgmental about this or anything like that. I'm just trying to say that there is a way that Christianity is supposed to be. And most of us fall short of that in some area in our lives. Now, I'm not suggesting we should accept that as normal at all. But the reality is that we fall short of that in some respects. I have known people, and you may have as well, who claimed to be faithful members of the Church of Christ, who accepted some responsibility to God and tried to do right most of the time, but God didn't inform their decisions at all. They didn't know what the Bible said, and they didn't live according to the Scriptures. It had no reality for them at all. But boy, you know, they presumed that the Church of Christ was their church home, and that's where they're going and what they're doing. So this isn't about what religious group people belong to. It is about where they are in their journey of faith. Let's speed along here and try to do some of these others. Step negative four, if they're continuing to move up, these people will begin to look positively at the Bible. And you can tell that because sometimes they'll actually read the Bible and they may start attending worship services from time to time. They're probably not terribly regular about it and probably not terribly interested in what's actually going on there. May like the music, may like the people, may like, you know, the whole scenario, but they really... What they need from you at this point is encouragement. They need you to be there. Yet presence figures strongly in all of this. We're talking about relationships here. And you don't develop a friendship with someone in order to manipulate that person. Right? You develop a friendship with someone because you have a genuine friendship with people. And your presence isn't going to go away if they haven't moved on to the next level in their journey of faith. They need your presence with them. They need your encouragement. They need some opportunities for basic information. In Acts 24, you have Paul standing in front of Felix, and he sends for Paul and listens to what he has to say. In verse 22 it says, "Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way," and the way is Christianity here, right? Everybody understands that, I think. It's the way of life. So Felix knows some things about the church, knows some things about Jesus, knows some things about the agitation that the Jews have with Christians. "Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes, he said, 'I will decide your case.' He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus." So Paul is giving him some basic information about Jesus. "As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, 'That's enough for now.'" A lot of people have that same reaction. You know, when you get sin and righteousness, those are nice, you know, kind of academic concepts until you get to that judgment to come. Then all of a sudden it gets real personal. And so he's afraid. "You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you." At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. Paul knows that what Felix needs is some better information and some more encouragement to obey. The next step above that is people become aware of these basics of the gospel, of sin and righteousness and judgment to come. And at this point, when people understand these things and begin kind of to assimilate the intellectual ideas of Christianity, they start coming to services. They start attending worship services, and they begin actually to know some people within the church. They're kind of developing a wider network of relationships. They start talking to some people and and understand some things better. And again, what they need here is your presence. They need a presentation of the gospel. Maybe they need someone to sit down with them at this point and do a home Bible study with them or talk about some things that are particularly troubling to them. A lot of people have questions about matters of faith. I don't know where to get the answers. And maybe you're the only spiritual reference that they know. A lot of people with serious religious and biblical questions will not talk to a preacher. You know that? They won't talk to a preacher because they're afraid what they will get is some kind of thundering condemnation and a bunch of theological double talk that they can't understand. And they just kind of feel intimidated and overwhelmed by some joker who stands up in the front every Sunday. So they don't want to talk to the preacher, but they'll talk to a friend and they'll ask some questions. And this could be a great opportunity just to explain some things about the gospel and what it means. And I think we've got an example of that in Acts 26. Another official here. Festus and Agrippa are listening to Paul now. 2 years have gone by. Felix didn't let him out of prison, so 2 years go by. Paul's still in prison. They're going to drag him out again. We've got a new governor on the scene, Festus. And Paul begins his defense, and Festus doesn't understand it, and so he makes the quite natural action in his mind that Paul, I'm not. He's so in verse 20, interrupted mind, Paul, learning is driving you insane. Because that can do that, right? You can go to school so long, you're just an idiot. I'm not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I'm saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I'm convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. Then Agrippa said to Paul, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? Paul replied, short time or long, I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am except for these chains. So Paul has made a presentation of the gospel to these people, and it doesn't work in Agrippa's case, but, you know, from time to time. Who knows where he is? He may have moved a short step. And if history's accurate in his fate, it didn't do any good. The next step up is where people begin to know some facts and understand the implications of the gospel. What does it mean to talk about my sins being forgiven? What does it mean to talk about me being in a relationship with God? And at this point, people begin actually to alter some of their behaviors. Some of the things that they used to do, they don't do anymore. Used to drink, for example. Now they know that's not going to take them any place, so they just kind of give it up. And it's not some huge conscious decision. Often it's more like they're just growing away from it. And some of the people they used to hang around with, they realize you're not taking them where they want to go. And again, they just see less and less and less of them and just kind of grow away from them. There's probably not some sharp line where they wake up one morning and say, well, I'm going to quit this and this and this and this. I'm going to take up this, 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 and this. It's more a process of just growing away from it. And again, what they need from you is presence and support and positive encouragement and inclusion. One of the things that one of these writers, I've been reading a couple of books on church growth, and one of the things that one of these guys said is assimilation, that's bringing a new Christian into the family, assimilation begins far before baptism. See, for a lot of us, we just kind of sit around and don't have a whole lot to do, and then these people are baptized, and we say, well, you're a member of the family now, let's get them involved and try to include them. Well, look, that should have been going on for a long time, so the whole inclusion idea needs to go along well before obedience to the gospel. These people need to know, this is a safe place. This is where people like you, and good things happen here. And so anyway, they need some inclusion there. And there's an example of that in Acts 17. I want to speed through these, if you don't mind. The one just before obedience is a willingness. A person is willing to confess and repent and be baptized. And you recognize these are people who are faithful in attendance, including Bible class. They come here frequently, and they sit with us, and they listen, and they pray. And what these people need at this point is some kind of personal challenge to obey. Very often, they're sitting there, and they're comfortable. They're not doing very much. They really want to be in a right relationship with God, but no one has ever come to them and essentially said, why don't you take the next step? You know, just come on and make the final surrender and be a Christian with us. So sometimes they just need that personal challenge to obey. Zero. The zero point is surrender to Christ. And I like that word surrender. We've probably kicked this around for the last 3 or 4 years. The talk in religious circles these days about becoming a Christian has to do with choosing Jesus. And you hear this stuff a lot. You make, choose Jesus. You need to choose Jesus just like you chose sin. There's an element of truth to that, and I don't want to negate that. But you know, if you go back through history and look at what they said 150 or 200 or 500 years ago, the word wasn't choose, the word was surrender. And I think the word surrender is a very powerful thing to say, because that's exactly what we're doing. We're surrendering our lives to Jesus. And there's a whole different mindset that goes along with the idea of surrender and submission to Christ than to choose. Because if we choose, we're still in control, right? If I make the choice, then I'm in control. I have decided to follow Jesus. Well, there's an element of truth to that, because the will has to be involved in this. But ultimately, what we're talking about is surrender. And what these people need here is encouragement and rejoicing. So you go to Acts chapter 8 and you read about the Ethiopian. He went on his way rejoicing. Well, what did he have to rejoice about? His sins are forgiven. He's in a right relationship with God. He's found the Lord. This pilgrimage that he, all the way from Ethiopia up to Jerusalem, that pilgrimage was not in vain. There are many personal reasons that he had to rejoice beyond that. It had huge implications for all of his life. Okay, but that's not the end of the journey of faith either. And I think sometimes we kind of presume that having gotten the person wet and had to run some towels through the laundry because of that, our work is done. Wow, that's great. All right, next. And it's not like that. There's much more yet to be done. After a person obeys Christ, you have the beginning of discipleship training. And this is what Doe was asking about earlier. Why the pluses and minuses? Well, because the journey doesn't stop. You know, we don't just keel over dead when we're baptized, say, okay, we're going to heaven now. You know, we've got much more yet to do. So we start this discipleship training. And the behavior that you see in people like this is personal prayer and Bible reading, the disconnection and reconnection of life becomes much more obvious. Disconnection happens as they leave some old associations and behaviors behind, and they start connecting with new associations and new behaviors. And again, this is a pretty gradual process. And this bothers some people. They begin to see that, and they don't quite know what to do about this. There was a guy that came to Lauren Giger. You all know Lauren from Oklahoma Christian. Many of you do. And this guy was talking to him. He said, well, you know, I'd like to be a Christian, but I don't know if I can leave my friends behind. I don't want to leave my friends behind. And Lauren looked at him and said, you don't have to leave your friends behind. You just obey the Lord, and they'll leave you. That's exactly right. If they're not interested in following the Lord, they will leave you. There is a process of disconnection and reconnection that takes place. Well, what these people need from you is support and encouragement and monitoring of them. We got to watch out for them a little bit. You know, it's easy for people to fall back into old, bad, sinful habits. Just ask Simon in Acts chapter 8. It's easy to fall back into lousy coping skills. These people also need to be included in ministry. I want you to go to Acts 11. There's something in the life of Paul we often overlook. I want you to go to Acts 11 because we think of Paul as this heroic figure who never needed any help from anybody. I mean, he got the gospel by revelation. He had this special vision of Christ on the road to Damascus, and he had all this education in his background. But look at verse 25 and 26. He has obeyed the gospel, had some isolation events go on. He's back home in Tarsus now. Then Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul, and when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. This guy needs some support and encouragement and some inclusion in this church. So for a whole year, Barnabas and Saul met with the church and taught great numbers of people, and the disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. Where did Paul learn to do ministry? Partly it's from hanging around with Barnabas. Barnabas has to get some of the credit for training Paul, probably helped to polish some of the rough edges off of Paul, at least as much of the rough edges as ever were polished off of Paul. Okay, beyond that, people go into reordering their family life, a plus two, you might say. They're growing and developing in their discipleship. They're reordering family life, starting to do things differently. Their personal finances and interests begin to reflect Christ's agenda in life. Typically, when people obey the gospel, their giving is at a very low level. Giving of time, giving of money, giving of interest is at a very low level. And it takes time for them to realize how important the Lord's kingdom is. And so, as they grow and develop, they start thinking, well, I need to give proportionally, just like the Lord said here, you know, a percentage of my income and so on. So they need to grow to that level. But when you see that behavior taking place, that their giving increases as a percentage of their income, they have a shift in their priorities, the things that are important in life change, and there's more of an integration of Christianity into their lives. You see these behaviors come along. Now you know where they are in this faith journey. They're continuing to develop and grow. And so what they need here is coaching, and they need some challenges to meet, because we all grow through challenges, right? How many of you were strong-armed, basically, into teaching a Bible class for the first time? Okay, how many of you praise God for that experience? You better believe it. You learn more about the Bible when you teach than you do any other way. But people don't like that stretching process. You know what they did to me? My first Bible class I taught was three-year-olds. Connie and I team taught three-year-olds for a quarter. That was an illuminating experience. Then they threw me into a junior high class. And I think the goal was, we'll throw this guy in there for a quarter, and at the end of the 13 weeks, we'll drag out whatever's left, and, you know, then we'll go find some other raw meat to throw to the animals. And I had a great time teaching the junior high class, and so I stayed with them, I think, for 2 years, and just taught that class for 2 years, and then most of them went to high school, so I went with them. I took over the high school class and taught that for a while. But the stretching is important. They need challenges to meet. And at this point, people need some leadership training. Yeah, they need to think seriously about who they are in relation to the kingdom and what they have to offer others. And they need to be trained and think about future roles and where they are and what they can do. And this is not male specific, okay, because women also need leadership training. They need to be able to bring other women behind them, teaching in the children's Bible classes, doing all kinds of ministry work that goes on. We're always surprised, I think, at how much people do in this person on his next step. Leon, I have no idea where that point exists. Okay, then you have to think, on the one hand, you have to think, I may be doing more harm than good, but on the other hand, let me point this out to you. If people have strong feelings about this, they at least care. That's a good sign. That actually is a good sign. People have strong feelings. If they really just don't care, you know, there's really not much discipleship that's going to take place there. They just don't care. But, you know, if you're never progressing, if all they want to do is argue and they will not change anything that they're thinking or believing on the basis of the Scriptures, you know, you show them in the text what it says, and they're not going to change, then, I don't know, you just keep praying for them. Do the best you can. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Okay, well, there's some hostility there. I have no idea what it is, but maybe you're just not the guy. Maybe another guy could come in and do a really good job with him, and maybe you're just not the guy. I do know I have not had any success at all with my immediate family members to talk to them. They know way too much about me to take me seriously. Let me point out just the last two steps here, because we're really out of time. The next step is people discover and develop their own spiritual gifts, and you see that when they take on new roles. What they need is more leadership roles and an expanded vision. They need to look bigger than their own little involvement in this one congregation. They need to look at the kingdom entirely. The examples that I have in Acts 16, 1 Thessalonians 3, and 2 Timothy all have to do with Timothy and show his steps in his discipleship growth along with Paul. And then the last one is, at the top, these people are improving their discipleship and godliness, and they can help other people in their faith journey and become very intentional about doing that and very intentional about their discipleship, and they are quite selfless. They're not thinking about themselves any longer. They're thinking about advancing the kingdom. And that comes along at the lower levels also. People are growing in that direction. But at this point, it's very, very obvious. Now, what does this person need? Needs somebody to mentor. Time to pass it on. Okay? I think these are just helpful for us to kind of look at how people grow and develop in their journey of faith. And I appreciate your time and your comments. And I hope this is of some interest and help to you. I just want to point out that conversion is the work of God. It's not our business to convert souls. God does that. We do have a role to play in bringing the message of the gospel to people, and remember that evangelism is a process and not an event. It doesn't happen just one day at one time. It is a process that goes along. All right?